Hi, this is Gilbert Gottfried, and this is Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host Frank Santopadre, and we're once again recording at Nutmeg with our engineer Frank Verderosa, who lost three episodes that were really good ones
not.
Through his incompetence. Our guest this week.
As the editor, he gets to cut that out of the show. He has total control.
Our guest this week is an actor, producer, musician, Academy Award-winning writer, and one of the most inventive, most popular, and most quoted stand-up comics of all time. As an actor, he's appeared in films like Reservoir Dogs, Desperately Seeking Susan, Coffee, and Cigarettes, Natural Born Killers, Babe, Pig in the City, Half-Baked, and a little film called The Aristocrats, and his own Oscar-winning short, The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. TV appearances include Mad About You, The Larry Sanders Show, Saturday Night Live, Conan, The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, Louie, Horace and Pete, and 19 memorable episodes of The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. His million-selling CDs, the Grammy-nominated I Have a Pony and I Still Have a Pony, are required listening for anyone interested in the art of stand-up comedy or the art of joke writing. Maybe he'll give me some free copies. Please welcome to the podcast a true Renaissance man, one of our favorite comics, and one of the world's funniest humans, the animated, excitable, and wildly energetic Stephen Wright.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Stephen. Thanks
did
for coming.
Did you write that?
Huh? Somebody did.
That was,
you think it was him?
No. Not from.
So,
I'm so happy
question.
To be here. Thank
what?
You so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, good.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, our first question, whatever happened to you? It seemed like you were going to be so big.
Oh, well. I decided to go away.
Was it coming out of the closet?
Well, it was, you know how transgendering is like. Is acceptable now. Like that, I was way ahead.
I was
20 years ahead. Transgendering.
You were pioneer.
Have you thought of transgendering?
Yes.
Do you have any name? Do you have any names?
What of people who are?
No. Of choices. Like if you do, do you have any names?
See, I don't quite understand
what I'm saying.
Now, is that people born both ways, or are these people having operations to change? I still don't.
No, it's people who aren't comfortable with their own gender, so they decide to change genders.
Yeah.
By having surgery.
So now.
To change their.
Now with.
I think.
With Bruce Jenner, or whatever he calls himself.
He's Caitlyn now.
Oh, Caitlyn Jenner.
She's Caitlyn.
What does he have and what doesn't he have?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Do you know, Steve?
You're asking me, in the first 2 minutes, you're asking me if I know what Caitlyn Jenner's actual body looks like.
Yes.
You know, when I was going to come here, I had no, you know, I had all the topics. That's what you want me to just answer that and then I'll leave?
Yeah.
Rather than leading up to that in about 40 minutes, you're just going to go right
Does he
in.
Have, as they call, sausage and veggies?
Where did you come up with that? That's a first.
I'm not sure, really. I'm not sure. This is the third time that's been asked of me today.
Now,
cab driver asked me that. The guy in the hotel.
Wow.
And I said to them, I don't know. And then I said, why are you even asking me that? And they said something about you. No, so why are you asking me?
Because
I brought it up.
Well, Like, if I ran into Caitlyn Jenner, should I offer him her a hand job? Just to be polite.
From one celebrity to another.
Yes.
Just to be hospitable.
I spoke to Sir Ben Kingsley about this.
What did he say?
Oh, we spoke for hours. We're going to get...
On that one subject?
Yeah, we're going to get together later tonight.
Man, I think I'm glad that... anyway.
Now,
to me, it's surrealism. To me, that stuff is surrealism.
People changing their gender?
Transgendering, yes. Yeah. It's like, because to me, surrealism is overlapping different realities, you know? So you got this guy who wants to completely be a woman and the other way around. It's like if Salvador Dali got in charge of sexuality for some people, that's what transgendering is to me.
Well, that clears that part.
I'm reminded of your Salvador Dali joke about the fishing line.
Oh, yeah, the dotted line.
Yeah.
He's one of my heroes, Salvador Dali.
Well, you're both, both of you are surrealists as comics. It's fair to say. You certainly are, Stephen. And Gilbert, there's a fair amount of surrealism in your act. Certainly a bit about a UFO landing on the lawn and an alien coming out and asking you a question about Ben Gazzara's career.
Yes. Yes.
Would qualify as surrealistic comedy.
I never met Ben Gazzara.
You never did?
That's one of those.
I wonder what he thought of that bit, if he knew about it.
Do you? Okay. Some reports.
I'm trying to patch anything together here.
What would Caitlyn Jenner think of that bit? That's what we need to research. Question.
Caitlyn Jenner, I think, was jerking off when I did that bit. And playing with his breasts.
Really?
Now, somebody told me,
some
reporter, that he was interviewing Ben Gazzara in his trailer. And he said, you know that comedian Gilbert Gottfried, and Ben Gazzara goes, he's smoking a cigar, and he goes, oh, yeah, with the eyes, and he goes, yeah, and he tells him the bit, and Ben Gazzara, like, lets out a big laugh, he goes, ha, 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 and he goes, and he hits him on the shoulder, goes, that's funny.
Who told you this?
Yeah, I know, some reporter.
Did Norman Fell know that you did a bit about him, too?
You know what? When I met Norman Fell, Steve, you want to go out and take a walk?
Yeah.
When I met Norman Fell,
we were just telling Steven how you met Norman Fell.
Yeah, I remember he said to me, and he was very nice, Norman, and a funny actor, and a good dramatic actor, too, and I remember... He was saying to me, I said, oh, you know, I do a bit about you. And he goes, most people who do a bit about me, it's more like a jab. And I felt so terrible because I always liked Norman Fell.
And your bit was not a jab.
No. It was like.
What did you say?
God, you remember it better than I do.
Well, it was the bit about Kurt Waldheim, the former secretary of the UN, was being accused of having a Nazi past. So Gilbert had a whole bit about, what was it?
When they surrounded his house, he said, I'm not Kurt Waldheim, I'm Norman Fell.
But then they shout up, you know, oh, how do we know you're Norman Fell? Prove it. And the joke was... remember your joke?
John Ritter was a consummate professional, and Cindy Williams had an endearing...
Not Cindy Williams. Was it Cindy Williams?
I think it was Cindy Williams. I think it was an endearing...
Wrong show. What? She would have been on Laverne and Shirley.
Yeah. Oh,
Joyce DeWitt.
Joyce DeWitt.
Right.
Joyce DeWitt. John Ritter was a consummate professional, and Joyce DeWitt had an endearing vulnerability.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was the bit. It loses a little something now out of context. Don't go away. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
I'm going away.
Stop it, you.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And now back to the podcasting stylings of Gilbert Gottfried.
When I think of you, I think of when you would do Bogart's ordering stamps.
Oh, yes, yeah.
That's all you had him say, right? That one thing.
Yeah, Humphrey Bogart or at the post office. Stamps.
That used to come at the end of the act when you would run through the quick impressions.
Oh, yeah.
You do Chico Marx and A View from the Bridge.
Oh, yeah. Hey, this is some nice bridge, yeah? And you know who liked the Humphrey Bogart bit? Kathy Lee Gifford. She was one of my earliest fans.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's nice.
That's what stays with you from his act, huh, Stephen?
And the thing you would hold a piece of paper up.
Oh, yes.
For the baggage.
You know who likes
the baggage?
That? You know who likes that napkin bit? Brooke Shields.
Really?
Brooke Shields said she went to a foot doctor, and while they were working on her feet, she picked up a napkin that he had on the desk and started doing all of my napkin jokes.
She did?
Yes.
Well, that's quite an homage.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
The plankton bit?
Oh, yes.
With the napkin and the trick-or-treating with the Dracula?
Yeah. So, Steve, I was talking to you. I think we had a conversation years ago across from Lincoln Center.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. I judge how beautiful a girl is by how hard it is to imagine her taking a shit.
Well, I think that's... I'm over here responding. Like, the way you said that, now you stopped, which means that the other guy is supposed to talk.
Yes,
right?
So, please.
Yeah, you know,
please,
Steve. That's very interesting. I find that very interesting. It's very, very interesting.
Don't worry, Steve. We can lift that out.
How long have you had? No, this you should leave it in. I like how I'm not actually saying anything. How did you, how long have you been thinking that?
Oh, God. Well, let's see.
Not in elementary school.
It started with what? I think it started with Theda Bara.
Who's that?
She was in silent films.
Yes. Do you know she was a silent screen star, Theda Bara?
Yeah.
And a Jew. Theda Bara was Jewish.
So what are you saying?
That Theda Bara was Jewish.
I mean, I thought you were making a connection of silent film and Jewish people.
You know who else? He wasn't in silent films.
You're associating.
I'm going to have to.
Who was Jewish?
As a translator.
Was Ricardo Cortez.
Yes, Ricardo Cortez. Yeah, he was Jewish.
He was something like Artie Krantz.
Love
or
it.
Something.
Love it. We talk about a lot of obscure shit on this show, Stephen.
Was that woman pretty, that silent film star?
Yes, very pretty.
So she would be, in your theory, theory, she would be very...
It'd be hard to imagine her taking a shit, like name an actress.
Oh, this is a new game show.
Joyce Boulafont.
Who?
I don't know. Jane Mansfield.
Well, kind of on the heavy side, so it wouldn't be that far a stretch. Because you figure she eats a lot of carbohydrates and roughage.
About
you know,
Jennifer Connelly.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that would be a tougher one. Yeah, yeah.
I'm not agreeing. I'm just listening.
Yeah, but Jennifer Connelly. But I saw you nod your head.
No, I didn't. That was an illusion.
You did.
No, you have double vision, partial double.
You had that look on your face like, I find it quite hard to imagine her taking a massive dump.
I had a look on my face that communicated that to you.
It's very recognizable.
Like, if I was walking down the street when I leave here, someone might pass me and think
they'll go, don't bother him. He's thinking about some old-time actress taking a shit.
This should be recorded.
Yeah. We should turn the mics on.
Yes.
What about Barry Fitzgerald? I'm just going to throw names out.
Who is he?
Now, Eugene Paulette.
Yeah. We covered Eugene Paulette.
Now,
we got to give Steve a key.
Yeah,
you know, to these.
Okay, Eugene Paulette, not only is it easy to imagine him taking a dump, but...
You know Eugene Paulette, Stephen. He was a character actor. He's in a lot of 40s movies.
He talked like this, short, stout.
So I would know him if I saw him.
Oh, in a second.
I'll dial him up for you.
It's like in fact, back then they would call him Froggy. That was his, like, nickname in the business. And he was a very bigoted guy. Not a very nice person.
So you can talk about him like this and not feel bad about it.
Your knowledge of this stuff is incredible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're, like, unbelievable. Like, did you start, like, all this, you know, the head is like a giant library. You must have been, yes. I see him.
He's in a lot of Capra stuff and Preston Sturges.
Now, Stephen.
Frank just showed me a picture of him. That's why I'm saying yes.
If you had to name the worst film you appeared in, I've got it down to two.
You've been putting this guy on the spot since he walked in here.
I can't do that. I can't.
It would have to be Son of the Mask. That face.
God.
Is Marie Dressler taking a shit?
Now I got to dial up Marie Dressler for Steven.
Okay.
No. It's going to be a long show.
Okay, so Son of the Mask, horrible, horrible movie.
Thank you.
And the equally horrible film, but ignored and in bad film territory. And that's So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Oh, my God. That movie's hilarious.
I like that film.
It's hilarious. It's funny. I must have missed that.
No, I think that's one of those
I must have been
movies.
Taking a shit in the funny part.
In a funny car? Did you say in a funny car?
Yeah. Sometimes I would take a shit when I was riding with the Keystone Cops. That would be a funny car.
Raceway Park.
Sometimes when I was in a scene from Mad Mad World and I would be in a funny car, I would take a shit there. And Terry Thomas would complain.
I have to say, I think So I Married an Axe Murderer is very funny.
You think it's funny?
Yeah, I do, and I'm not just saying it. I mean, I have no reason to just say it.
You know what? If you think that's funny, can we just talk about actresses taking a shit?
Fine, yes.
What are your two worst movies, Gil?
How can you narrow it down?
Funky Monkey?
Oh, Funky Monkey is Funky right Monkey. Up there.
Uh-huh.
And I've never seen it.
Of course. I'm scared
to see it.
Of course.
Is that an animated movie?
The what?
No, it's live action.
Live action.
What is
now,
it about?
Now, Funky Monkey. And I was in the second version of Funky Monkey. They
too?
Had filmed it once before.
And they didn't release the first one?
Yeah, I think it was in France they first shot Funky Monkey. And they would have some scenes with an actual monkey and other scenes with an angry French midget, an angry drunken French midget, which he'd be like blasted out of his skull, stumbling around
in the movie.
Monkey
he wasn't
suit.
Really drunk.
He was an angry guy,
and he was interacting with a monkey.
No, he was supposed to be the monkey.
Oh, he was the monkey,
and they had him dressed up in a monkey suit. And for some reason, maybe he wasn't that proud of himself.
What was the plot of Funky Monkey?
That's the French version.
Well, they were originally going to call it Spy Chimp, so that'll let you know.
Okay.
And the other one was Hairy Tails. And I guess Matthew Modine was in it. And so that's you, quite, a, you know, you go from working with Stanley Kubrick.
Right.
To, to Funky Monkey.
That's showbiz.
You worked with Stanley Kubrick?
The what?
No, Modine in Full Metal Jacket.
Oh, yeah.
No, the Angry French Midget.
he was in
2001.
Yes, he played one of the creators on the moon. I remember now.
What's your favorite movie? Not one you were in.
Well, you know, for years I used to say it's Harold and Maude. And, like, you know that movie, right?
You know something?
Don't tell me you've never seen Harold and Maude.
I've seen bits and pieces of it.
Ruth Gordon and...
Bud Cort.
Bud Cort. And, like, I grew up in Massachusetts. And in Harvard Square, that movie played for, like, 5 years as a double bill with...
Funky Monkey.
Funky Monkey. No,
they used to play with King of Hearts.
King of Hearts. Yeah. That's it. How did you know?
Because there was a double bill that was everywhere across
the
country.
Oh, it was? Yeah. Oh, my God. That yes, that's what it was about the Insane Asylum.
That's right.
And I would see that movie several times, Harold and Maude. It just was very touching to me because it wasn't just funny. You know, it was about life and death and living and, like, Hal Ashby.
Oh, the great Hal Ashby. He's come up on this show a lot.
Oh, I love so many of his
being
movies.
There.
When VCRs first came out, my girlfriend had one, and I went down to rent two movies. And at the time, I wasn't into directors. This was like 1985. I didn't know who directed anything. Mm-hmm. I just wasn't into. I go rent two movies. I put one in, and I watched, and it was like Harold and Maude. Okay, where are you? And I took it out of the thing and put the next one. It was Being There, and it starts, and I see Hal Ashby, and I go, wait a minute. I'm not even sure if that was the same guy. So I take it out and put Harold and Maude back in. Same guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's amazing.
He had a great run.
The sensibility, not even knowing that he had done those.
Well,
What was the music? Cat Stevens?
The Cat Stevens music.
And that one song that was specifically for that movie. He wrote one song for it. Don't Be Shy. Don't be shy.
I just saw him perform at the Beacon.
A couple months ago?
Yeah, absolute treat. He hadn't been in New York in 40 years.
Wow.
It was an absolute treat. And he did those Harold and Maude
songs.
Yeah. It was great. I got some video. I'll show it to you later.
I
got it on my
phone.
Ashby had a great run. Coming Home, Shampoo. He made the Woody Guthrie movie, Bound for Glory, with David Carradine. And Being There. And what am I forgetting? The Landlord?
Oh, yeah.
And The Last Detail, which you love.
Oh, yeah, The Last Detail.
Yeah, great run.
Yeah, Jack Nicholson and Randy Quaid.
Well,
before he went completely over. Randy Quaid, my favorite thing about him is, you know, either the police are after him or, as he said, the celebrity whackers.
Yes.
Which is
the celebrity.
It's a gang of people who jerk off celebrities, I guess. I've been trying to find them. I would go to their headquarters if there were celebrity whackers.
Funky Monkey knocked you off their list.
Yeah, always that French midget always gets in before I do. And so to hide out, he goes to faraway Canada. And he does a press conference to announce
that he's hiding out
in Canada right now, which I don't know if it's the smartest thing to do if you're hiding out.
He just thinks people are after him, right?
Yeah.
He's very funny in a movie called Quick Change. You know this movie, Bill Murray movie?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's just terrific in that. Tony Shalhoub, too. So you're starting to say that Harold and Maude used to be your favorite.
Well, you know, it was interesting. You have these movies, and I can ask both of you guys if this has happened to you. You have a movie, and that's my main movie, you know, and you watch it for every 3 or 4 years, still. And then there's this time when you watch it, like, and it's, I don't think it is anymore. But that's because you've changed. Obviously, the movie hasn't changed.
Are there any movies?
There's another one you'll be surprised, maybe. The Summer of 42.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Gary Grimes.
Gary Grimes. Yeah. I saw that a couple months ago, and I didn't really know that it was made in like seven. I was the same age as that kid in the movie, and I didn't even know that till when I watched it a few months ago. That movie has such a quiet, like, you know, it's just beautiful. It's amazing. That's one of my favorite movies, too.
What movies that you can name did you see at one time say, this is like the greatest movie ever made, I love it, and then see it like shortly afterwards and go, oh, this is crap?
That never happened to me. Does that happen to you?
You fall out of love with a movie that quickly?
Oh, and well, I don't know if it's like that short amount, but there have been movies I've seen where I thought, oh, this is great. And then I saw it again. They went, all right.
Like a few years later, like?
Yeah.
No, I've never had that.
There have been movies I saw in film school or 20 years ago that I loved, like Strangers on a Train.
Yeah.
Hitchcock's, which I then saw 20 years later or 25 years later as an adult, and I didn't think quite as much of it.
Yeah.
But that's rare.
Yeah.
That you should love something and then completely do a 180 on it.
Well, I think what happens when you go to movies when you're young and going to... Well, it always got me when people say they'll criticize a movie because they'll say, oh, the movie was very manipulative. And I'm saying, well, movies are manipulative. And to me, that's like saying... Oh, that magician, it's not real magic. He's doing tricks. And it's a matter of, you know, yes, you know it's tricks, but if the magician's good, you're going, how did he do that? And you're fascinated.
I never thought of that. They are all manipulative. Because I've had movies where I've watched that I didn't like because they were so manipulative. And I never thought that all of them are really.
Yeah, because, I mean, the greatest films... have scenes that they want you to start crying. They want you to laugh. They want you to be at the edge of your seat.
Yeah, with the music pushing you that way.
You resent that, that you're being so directed?
No, but what happens is when you're younger, you fall for it more.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then after a while, you see the tricks.
Right.
And you start to watch it and go, okay. They're doing that overhead shot. Now the music's starting to come on, and now they're pulling back, and you.
David Lynch is one of my favorite directors, and I think he's fascinating to me because I don't know what any of the movies are about.
Oh, yeah.
I don't. And
stylish
I love
as hell, though.
What's that?
They're stylish as hell, though.
I'm drawn to them, which is really bizarre because if you can't follow a story or something, you would lose interest. You know, if it's not, you know, but there's something about him where, I mean, it is surreal. I love surrealism, and I'm very drawn to his movie. He's one of my favorite directors. He would talk about music movies being like paintings that had sound.
Interesting.
That's how he would describe movies.
Well, I think people who claim they understand the David Lynch movie are lying.
Well, there's some with a straighter narrative.
Yeah.
I mean, The Elephant Man is
that's a movie. That was like Mulholland Drive and that one with Robert Blake.
Is it Wild at Heart?
No, that's with Nicolas Cage.
There was that
Cage.
One he has on, like almost like a clown makeup, Robert.
I know, I'm trying to think of the one you're talking
about.
Yes,
that's the one, and he calls his house, and he answers his house. He's somewhere else, and he calls his house.
Our listeners are screaming at their devices now.
You know what's so weird is that when you just take him as an actor, Robert Blake was a fine actor. Like, I mean, in that and in
Lost
Cold
Highway.
Blood.
Yeah.
That's the one you're thinking of.
He's one of those that will always be remembered for the wife. And he'll never be, you know, like as an actor. He's not remembered anymore.
And now while Gilbert heads into the Nutmeg Kitchen to steal more Perrier, a word from our sponsor.
For the first time, The Complete Woman is now available on Earwolf, completely free. It's 1962. Do you know where your husband is? Maribel May is here to save your marriage on The Complete Woman, a pitch-perfect send-up on Vintage Self-Help Records, written by and starring Amanda Lund, who you may know from Spontanean Nation and Super Ego, and featuring Matt Gurley, Maria Blasochi, and Stephanie Allen, and more. Hear The Complete Woman on Apple. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. And if you want more, you could find Maribel's follow-up series, The Complete Joy in the Complete Man, on Stitcher Premium. Just go to www.stitcherpremium.com/complete. It'll improve your marriage or your husband's money back. Maribel guarantees it.
And now back to more hilarity and trenchant insight, Gilbert Gottfried. There's a Lynch movie called The Straight Story, too. Do you know this one? With Richard, you know that actor Richard Farnsworth?
Oh, yes, yes. He was in Missouri as the sheriff.
What is that? About a
guy who rides a tractor.
Yes, all the way across somewhere.
Yeah, to visit his brother.
Wasn't Bruce Dern?
No, it was Richard Farnsworth, who was an old stuntman cowboy actor.
Yeah.
And it's really sweet. That's a Lynch film that was just a straighter narrative.
Yeah.
For Lynch. What did you watch? I mean, I know you grew up in Burlington, Massachusetts, and I read that your brother controlled the TV remote, and that's how you got into Carson.
Yeah, I mean, he was in charge of the television. He was 4 years older than me, and like on a Friday night, everyone would be in bed, and me and him would be in the living room, and I would sit back on the couch, and he would sit on the floor and with his hand up on the channel changer, and he loved Johnny. He loved him. Mm-hmm. So I had to watch him because I had no say. And then when Johnny would go to a commercial, he'd go to the other two channels, and then he'd come back to Johnny to make sure he didn't miss anything. And from that over and over, that's how I was drawn into it. Like, then I started watching it. I started to love it because he controlled the television.
You watched Brenner and Pryor and
Brenner
Carlin
and Robert Klein.
Rodney would do a lot of those.
Rodney and guys that would come on and maybe you would never see them ever again. That was when I was drawn, like, wow, look at this guy. He comes on and he talks about life for 5 minutes and he's hilarious. And then he goes and sits with Johnny. I don't remember seeing stand-up on Ed Sullivan. I probably did, but it had no thing. Maybe I was too young. Mm-hmm. Seeing this guy do it, Carlin, my hero, seeing this person do this, it just slowly was like, wait a minute, I would like to be one of those guys.
And what gets me about Carson, much like Saturday Night Live, is it's got the reputation of someone goes on it, you see them for 5 minutes, and they're a major star. But you forget the millions of people who've been on both Carson and Saturday Night Live who you don't remember their names or what they did.
Except freaks like us remember their
names. Oh, yeah, yeah. We'll remember.
I'll remember every comic
but
I ever
like
saw
like normal
Carson.
People.
Yeah, like you would see somebody like Steve Landisberg come out and do stand-up on Carson in those
days.
Yeah,
he was great. He was fantastic.
I'm trying to think of Skip Stevenson. There were guys, remember him?
Yeah, and
Bluestone.
Yeah,
he
Jeff
was
Altman.
Hilarious.
And there was
Jeff
one
Altman,
comedian
amazing.
Who I think started out as Daphne Davis, and then after doing it for a few years, changed her name to Maureen Murphy.
I remember her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're amazing.
In those days, that was, that's old school talk shows, too, where you could have a comic come out and do 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You don't see that anymore.
You'd have, like, a newscaster and a dramatic actor and a comic all sitting on the panel together.
Right. And we were talking before we turned the mics on about the old school guys that you'd see on Carson, like Hackett, like Jackie Vernon, Biner.
Biner, and of course, I mean, Don Rickles,
And Rickles.
Course. Don Rickles is one of the greatest of all time. I remember when Johnny would say who was on the next week, he would mm-hmm. lead the guests and he was going to be on. I was excited. I mean, I loved Don Rickles. Even in the last 5 or 6 years, I would look him up on my phone on YouTube. I would have like I have to see Don Rickles with Johnny. You know, he put Johnny, Don mm-hmm. Rickles, and I watched these appearances. I would go through phases like 5 times a year where I had to see them. Like, it's incredible. How did you? He was unbelievable. There was no one like him.
I know he's on your Mount Rushmore of comedy.
He is. He's incredible.
Did you see him live?
So fast. No, I never saw him live. Did you ever see him live?
Gilbert did.
Oh, yeah. I saw him live. Me and a friend snuck into Westbury. And, yeah, saw Don Rickles live. Yeah, he was great.
What a mind. Yeah. And nobody even close to him. There's not even a guy near him. I mean, it's completely in his own category.
I never met him. Have you?
I met him a few times, and he was very nice.
Yeah,
very
that's
sweet,
what I heard.
Sweet person. Yeah.
Never had the chance to meet him.
He was an event guest on Carson, like you say. Somebody you knew was coming on, like Rodney. You had to.
Yes,
you had to watch.
This other level of them going on. It was extra exciting.
Yeah, or Steve Martin.
Yeah.
Too.
And I remember with Rodney Dangerfield, first he'd come out and do a set, which would be hysterical, and then the panel would be even
funnier.
That
was the second set.
Yeah,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
How you doing?
It was like a double set. He'd do another 10 minutes sitting down.
Yeah, it was sort of like, so Rodney, how are you?
Right. That was it.
Well, I'm okay now, but last week I was in rough shape.
That was it. And he do 20 minutes.
Yeah. And my doctor, Dr. Vinnie Gunbots.
Now that I think of it, he never actually said anything real.
No,
he never said anything about it.
No, he wasn't
life.
A real interview.
The panel was a whole second set, and I liked the panel even better than the stand-up. It was so ridiculous.
The flies chipped in to fix the hole in the screen because his wife was such a terrible cook. Just do one after the other. And then one every now and then one wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And he'd just take that one out and he'd cross it off.
He took a break, right? Didn't he do it for years, and then he took like a 20-year break where he didn't do it?
He has an interesting history.
But I heard he wrote jokes during that time, and then he came back in his 40s or even 50s.
I think he was Jack Roy.
Jack Roy.
In the beginning, and he has a very strange
past. And
then, past.
According to...
He's a Tin Man. He was selling aluminum siding.
Wow. Yeah, and something crooked was happening, and the police...
Well, Cliff Nesteroff is the man to check with on that. He might... Rodney reportedly was kind of caught up in some scandal for selling siding to widows and...
widows.
Before he clawed his way, found his way back into stand-up. He didn't have the no respect thing when he first started out.
No,
he developed that over
later.
The years.
Did you meet him?
What? Oh, Rodney. Rodney, in fact, I did two bad movies with.
You were in Meet Wally Sparks.
Meet Wally Sparks.
How could we forget?
And you'll never know the name of the next movie.
Something About Midnight.
Yeah, Back by Midnight.
Back by Midnight. I listened to you on the other episodes.
Oh,
I know that surprises
okay.
You.
Knicks, the New York Knicks?
What?
Did you say Knicks movie?
The next movie.
Next.
Yeah. And I remember one time seeing Rodney on stage, and he was trying out stuff, and the audience just wasn't with him.
Really?
And he goes, he stops for a while, and he's, fixing his tie and looking both ways. And then he goes, hey, if anybody tells you you're a hot crowd, you spit in their face, okay?
You saw him say that?
Oh, yes.
I saw him at Westbury a bunch of times.
Did they laugh when he said that?
Oh, yeah.
How did you get into doing stand-up? How were you drawn into that?
Okay, I was, a kid who watched way too much TV. Wasn't good at sports, wasn't that popular. And I started, imitating people I saw on TV, like actors and comedians and stuff, and joking around.
Imitating to your friends or just for
yourself?
Yeah,
just to my friends, to my sisters and stuff. And then one of my sisters told me a friend of hers said about there was some club in Manhattan that you just came in, you wrote your name down, and when they got to you, they said your name, and you went up and did a few minutes. And I did that. I traveled from Brooklyn with my sisters to Manhattan. And I did that, and I remember I was mainly like an impressionist. It was like Rich Little or Frank Goshen. I was doing impressions.
You just got up and did Lugosi and that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Gleason.
Even back then, it was dated material I was doing.
But before you knew of that club, did you want to do that? And then when you heard the club, then you say, oh, now I can go there?
Oh, yeah.
And so then how did it got in your head from watching a lot of television?
Yeah.
and comedians on talk shows or just television
comedians on talk shows or just actors where I started imitating them. And once again, I always say this, and it's true. I had total stupidity on my side because stupidity that says I could make it in show business.
Yes, yes.
And more stupidity that goes, you know, well, the odds aren't against me. That's pretty fucking stupid.
But you were young, too. You were 15.
Yeah.
15.
Yeah.
And the stupidity that when I go on stage and I would bomb and I would still want to go back, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. When you're that young, you're so optimistic. If you think of the reality, the statistics of it, it's probably not going to happen.
It's just like nowadays when someone says they're an aspiring comic. Like back then, I thought, yeah, I could be the next Bob Hope, so what? But nowadays, if someone wants to be an aspiring comic or someone says, oh, what if your kids wanted to be in showbiz? I would think, well, I understand digging through trash cans and taking out soda cans to turn in for a 5-cent deposit. That makes sense to me. At least that's rational.
Mm-hmm.
But being in show business nowadays seems so irrational.
Well, I think two different things. I think that statistically, it's like part of me thinks, yeah, you want to go into this, but you really shouldn't because the chances of it really happening is so remote. And there's a lot of luck, timing, luck that has to line up. And then I think, but wait a minute. It happened with me, so why couldn't it happen with them?
Neither of you had parents that had anything to do with show business.
No.
Your dad worked for NASA for a time, and then...
Well, he was an engineer, and they tested stuff that went up on the Apollo. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things he did.
Did you approach your parents at any point and discuss this with them and say, I'm thinking of getting up at a club and trying...
No, as a matter of fact, I didn't even tell anybody. I didn't tell any of my friends. When I was watching Johnny in the early 70s and it got into my head, I was like, that's what I want. My dream is to do that. And I didn't tell anybody because I thought if I told anybody, it would jinx it.
I see.
And it wouldn't happen. So I was in all through school, out of high school, in college, out of college, then heard about the Comedy Connection in Boston. And then I told my friend Mike I was going to go out to the club. To the open mic, and he went with me. But that was the first time. I never talked about it at all. It was no show business.
And now, when I think of it with like more adult mind, as much as my mind can be adult, I'm thinking like, oh Christ, what my parents must have been thinking when, like, you know, like, oh look, I'm going to be the next Charlie Chaplin or something. That's how I'll make my living.
My father, when he said to me once in the clubs before I was on television, he said, "Why don't you know? You should think about getting a job, or getting a real job." And he was just trying to, you know, take care of me. But the thing, the young thing, that innocent thing you're talking about, you're naive, you're happy, you didn't know. It's like the pilots of jets, like F-16 warplanes. You know those guys? They're like. They're that young age where they're not thinking anything's going to happen. Let's go. Let's just go.
It's like the
foolhardiness of youth.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, it's not like, gee, the other guy has bullets in his plane, too.
Yeah, their planes might be better.
And that other guy's a skilled pilot also.
I've heard you say, Stephen, when you think about it, it's really an abnormal thing to do, to go out and make strangers laugh with stuff you made up.
It is abnormal. Yeah. It's very weird. And it's especially when I'm doing shows consistently, it's like a normal, it's an abnormal thing that it appears to be normal. Just because it happens over and over, it's like an illusion that makes it normal, but it doesn't really. But then when I haven't done a show for like a month or something, then when I'm backstage or on the side of the stage, when I'm not used to it because I've had so much time off, then it's really like, What are you kidding me? I have to go out there and do that? See, this is insane.
I had this.
Even after 30 years.
Yes.
After. See, I think.
Absolutely.
I think stage fright actually gets worse the more experience you've had.
Really?
Because when you're young, when I was in my teens, you could have said, oh, we want you to go out in front of this audience of 20 billion people, and it's going to be broadcast live around the world. And you go, oh, okay. And now I always have this fantasy, right, as I'm about to go on stage, that the manager is going to come out to me and go, oh, we had a fire or a flood, and so the show's canceled. Here's your check. Oh, you can go home now. And I think that's my fantasy.
Still now?
Oh, worse than ever.
I work with a lot of comics that say that, too.
Yeah.
Still, I'm not going to name them. But still have that same anxiety. People who've been very successful in doing this 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Is there any, and we'll look for any excuse to not go up.
Oh, exactly. Right. See, when I'm on stage, then I'm there.
Yeah. That's easier than when you're back about to go on.
Because when I'm about to go on, to me, I compare it to, you know, when you're about to go in either in the ocean or in a pool and you're dipping your toe in, you go, oh, my God, that's so cold. And then when you're actually in the water, then you're okay.
Yeah.
You've dealt with it. But you start inching in and it's freezing. And then you're in there. It's okay.
Yeah, it's better doing it than thinking about doing it.
Now,
it's not a normal thing. It's not a normal thing.
No.
I would tell my road manager, it's like, I shouldn't even really be doing this. I've been telling it for years. Like, not like I'm going to quit. I mean, it's completely against my personality. I'm such an introverted. I don't look at me. Every comedian wants the attention. It's like a catch-22. You want the attention, but really you don't want any regular life, you know? It's like I do this thing pretty good that I shouldn't even really be doing.
Well,
that's how I feel about
it. It's a split personality, obviously, where there's one part of you that says, I'm great, and the world will leave their houses and pay money to see me. And the other part of you is, oh, can you please love me? That's all I want. I just want you to love me.
I never think the first part.
Yeah.
About I'm great.
Well, I've never thought you were.
Thank you. So I'm right. So I'm right then.
We're in full agreement on this. I've never thought you were even mildly entertaining.
Oh, God. I'm so happy that there's other people. There's probably a lot of other people. My God, I see the show almost like if you were running across a lake of ice, and then the ice is breaking behind you.
Yeah.
Like it takes an hour to get across, and you gotta get it across. It's like, to me, it's like walking a tightrope. It's so intense. Don't you think it's intense out there?
Yes.
It's just everything's magnified. Everything is. So I'm not thinking, oh, I'm great. It's almost like I want to try to get away with it another time. Let me get away with it again. That's how I see it.
I've heard you say all you're thinking of is getting to the next joke because you don't want to go that far without hearing a laugh.
Yes, that's why I didn't know this until years later, but that's when I thought, when I was doing it like 10 years, I thought, well, why are the jokes so short? Why are they so short? And then I figured it out. It was because I didn't want to be standing there talking some big setup.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted them to be laughing because that was more comfortable than no laughing during the setup.
Sure, of course.
And sometimes you get those audiences where you have to, you can't ride a wave with them. And you have to, it's like an audition with each bit you do.
Oh, yes.
You say.
Yes. It's like, what do you think of this one? It is. Yeah. It's an audition. It's 500 auditions in 80 minutes.
You say a joke, it gets a big laugh, and then the next joke, they've already forgotten about you, and you have to prove yourself again.
Yes, because some audiences, just because that one went big, you can't trust the next one. You can't trust them. It's almost like going out. I see it almost like sometimes with going out with a woman.
I wouldn't know.
Having, oh, getting back to, what's his name, Jenner? You wouldn't. sometimes I'm out there and it's going really good, but I don't trust it. And it's like relationships. So many relationships didn't work out, but for a long time it was going good, you know? And it's like, sometimes I feel like that with the audience. It's like, yeah, I know you're there right now, but I don't trust it. I don't really know what's going to happen. That doesn't mean it's going to go like that for the whole way. And I'm almost waiting for when the turn is. Sometimes there isn't a turn, but lots of times there is a turn.
Well, so many people in the business feel, I definitely feel this, but so many, I've heard it from so many other people, famous people, who go like, oh, like they haven't found out yet. They haven't found out that I'm a fraud. And it's like...
yeah, I've heard that.
Like you're sneaking by.
Yeah.
One day they're going to discover it.
Yes. And there's some of those names. I've heard that too, and I don't remember the specific people, but whatever the people were, he was like, that guy thinks that?
Yeah,
that,
legendary people.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
My sister told me that a few years ago, she read something about Elvis that he was afraid before he went on. He was nervous before he went on. Can you imagine? Would you think that he was? I mean, as a guy. How much? I mean, look at how they reacted to him.
Somebody who told
I was stunned by that.
That is stunning. Somebody who I know who opened for Rickles told me that he took three belts, that he took three big glasses of vodka
before
he went out on stage because he needed the. And you would think at that stage, at that late stage, for a comic that can't get any bigger. Has every reason to have confidence and not have stage fright. Still happening.
I think I'm going to have to start drinking vodka.
Let me ask you something, Gillen.
Yeah.
I think I know this about Stephen because I saw it in the research. But,
okay, so we don't need Stephen.
Well, I'm going to ask him too. Do you know, you have so much material built up after all these years, and I've seen your act 100 times. Do you know, if I go see you at Caroline's on a Saturday night, do you know exactly what you're going to do in that set? Or... do you have some of it in mind and some of it's just coming to you on stage?
Yes.
You randomly cherry-picking things on stage as you think of them?
Yeah. Sometimes, like, I'll sort of say, okay, I'll start off with this bit, you know, just instinctively. And then others, when I'm there, I'll go, okay, I have to do another bit here. That one I haven't done
for. So you're free associating
on
stage and just pulling things out of the bag.
Yeah.
The other day I was in a restaurant... and I said, I want a cup of coffee. And the waiter said, how do you like your coffee? And I said, I like my coffee the way I like my women. Hot and black with a small piece of prune danish. Yesterday, I was having dinner with Charles Manson. And in the middle of dinner, he turned to me and said, is it hot in here or am I crazy?
Does it depend on how you're summing, how you're sussing out the crowd?
Well, you know what's weird is a lot of times if it's a crowd that's not with you, and you go into a bit, and it's one of these long bits, and you go, oh, shit. You get this feeling like you're driving, and you missed your exit. And now you have to drive for a few more miles.
To get to the way you can turn around.
Yeah, you can't get out now. And you go, oh, shit. The exit was right there.
Oh, my God.
You don't do some of those longer, drawn-out bits. You used to do that bit about the island of one-name people.
I know.
Celebrities and the island of three-name
people. I should bring that back.
And that was like a six-minute bit.
Yeah.
And you don't have the patience for them anymore?
Yeah, or maybe I should have an earphone. And someone off stage going,
Bob and Dolores at the end. Bob
Hope. My God.
Dolores feeding him the lines.
Seriously?
Well, his daughter, I think, Linda, was feeding him lines at the end of the
earpiece. You owe this to yourself.
Yeah.
you owe this to yourself. In the last Bob Hope special...
turning Stephen right onto Jack Frost?
Yes, he plays... He does a skit, a musical number where he's Jack Frost. And he's like, you know, about 1,000 now, and he looks 2,000. He looks like he died 20 years ago, Hope. His eyes are like all glazed over and red, and his mouth is hanging open. But they've got him in a goofy costume. It's like taking someone with Alzheimer's out of his wheelchair and slapping a funny hat.
He's wearing fake icicles. He's Jack Frost.
And his wife's doing most of the heavy lifting there.
Yeah. We'll show it to Stephen later.
What do you mean she's doing most of the heavy?
Well, she's singing and doing a little whatever dancing she can do.
Yeah, Dolores.
And I always, when I watch that bit, I always think, this is Dolores getting even to Bob Hope for all the times he fucked around on her.
But even the stand-up, even the monologues in those old specials.
Oh, my God.
The story is that his daughter was whispering lines to him in an earpiece.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he was 110. There's nothing to be ashamed of.
I think with Rodney, they started doing that.
I believe that's true.
And really? With Rodney, as great as his Carson was... All those Carsons were terrific. But then he started coming on The Tonight Show with Leno. And he was already older then. And I remember I would watch him and go, oh, God, I wish he would just stop. I really want him to retire so we could remember him when he was great.
So I'm going to be feeding you the honeymooners in your ear in about 12 years? Steve, you said when you started that you were like a Rolodex in your head. You knew exactly where you were going, and now it's a little bit different. Now you say you know about 90%.
Well, when I started, I knew exactly. I knew the exact jokes in order. Then as the material piled up, then I had it into my head and divided in three sections.
Okay.
Three Rolodexes, like the first third of the show, the second... And then the third. So then I would be saying one joke, and I would think, now what can I do after, while I'm saying that joke? Do you do that when you're deciding the next bit?
Oh,
you
yes.
So you're saying something, but you're thinking about what can be next.
It's so weird when you're on stage, and I've heard this about dramatic actors rock singers and people who look like they're just performing their guts out. Tears and sweat going down, and they're thinking about what they're going to have for dinner later on. And I find that I'll think about the next bit. Oh, here's something that happens to me. I'll be in the middle of a bit, and I'll do this one. I'll hit a line, and I'll go, you know, that line never really worked the way I wanted it to work. That always should have been a stronger line there. I should really put something else there. And then I'll go, oh, this bit usually works well. Or should I follow this with this? Or does it need something different?
This is why it's saying jokes.
The what?
It's all in your head. You're saying something like that. It's amazing what can go through your head while you're doing the show. I used to joke to people, it would be my friends, if there was a, you know, the sign that goes across Times Square with the news, you know how it goes around the
building?
If there was one of those above the stage, like, and you could see what the performer was thinking about.
Yes, because when you're reading the other one's coming along.
I got to call, you know, but I had it in thirds, and I would pick it when I would go. And then I took 6 months off, and when I came back, this was like 20 years ago. When I came back, I didn't know how I was doing that. I thought, I don't know, how am I saying one joke and then deciding what the next one is while I'm saying that one? Then I changed it completely. Now, and then I thought, I'll know the whole thing now, exactly all the way through, which is great because I don't have to waste any of my energy on deciding the next thing. Now I can just, perform each joke. Rather than wasting test.
Mm-hmm. That feeling that I'll get sometimes where you're on stage performing and then all of a sudden out of nowhere it hits you and you go, I'm on stage in front of a group of strangers and I'm telling jokes and making faces. What the fuck am I doing?
You're still having that feeling.
Yes, all yes, these- yes. All of a sudden, it just hits you.
Seems perfectly rational.
No, I don't. I don't have that. I don't. I'm just trying to like do it and trying to be a Buddhist, like trying to be in that moment of that. That's hilarious. You go, you look at you from the self from the outside, going,
yeah,
what the
and I'll go, this doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Was your first joke you wrote the joke about the French girl in the bookstore? Was it the first joke you did at the Connection?
It was the first joke I did at the open mic.
Uh-huh.
And it started talking to this very French, went in a bookstore talking to this very French looking girl. She was a bilingual illiterate. She couldn't read in two different languages. I don't know if it was the first one I wrote,
uh-huh,
but that was the first one. Wow, uh-huh, you were with like the FBI, yeah.
Well, I try to do a little digging.
That's
you don't remember your first joke, Gil? Have any? It was impression, right?
What was the name of that club when you went with your sister from Brooklyn?
Do you know something? I'm all confused with that because for years I thought it was the Bitter End. And then my sister said it wasn't the Bitter End. It was some other. So I don't
know. You were with Arlene?
Yes.
Was it the Village Gate? One of those? Was it downtown?
It may not have even been in that area.
So it wasn't a comedy. They didn't have a comedy club?
It was a mixture. Well, back then, those clubs, there'd be a comedian and a folk singer.
Folk City or Comedy U Grand had
music.
Yeah,
those type of places.
Like in the 70s, you mean?
Well, I think it was like might have been 69.
Wow.
Jesus. Yeah.
And do you remember anything of your first thing that you said?
The earliest joke I remember wasn't on stage, but I remember it could have been in kindergarten or the first grade. And the teacher was talking, and she was carrying a newspaper for some, maybe telling us what a newspaper was. And one kid was obviously not paying attention. He was looking in the other direction. And she took her newspaper and placed it on his head. And I said, those are the headlines. And it got a laugh.
Oh, you said that in the class?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
It got a laugh.
That's hilarious.
That's the earliest joke I remember saying.
Wow. Did you have a class clown thing going on back
then?
No,
you know, I always said I think the class clowns are the ones that wound up to be those guys that come up to you after a show and say, you know, in my job, I'm the funniest guy. Yeah.
Right. The quiet ones are the ones that you have to watch out
for. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I never wanted the attention of the class. I would make my buddies laugh, but I didn't want the attention. But I remember the first time in like third or fourth grade, we had to go up in front of the class and say something, not a joke, but anything we had to do. And my father and I, my family would watch the Jackie Gleason, we watched the Honeymooners, but there was another one. Remember the one after that?
Oh, the one that he did in Miami.
Yeah, with Crazy Google.
Oh, yeah, the Jackie Gleason show from
and
Miami.
He would end each one with, the Miami Beach audience is the greatest audience in the world. Good night, everybody.
Yeah. Sure, with the tan.
Yeah. So, and the pinky rings and the drink, alcohol and cigarette.
It was someone told a joke on that show, and I was in third or fourth grade. So I went up to stay on the front of the class, and I told the joke. And when I walked back to my seat, Brian Owens, imagine him seven. He said, you didn't tell it right.
Seven.
The joke was the cop stops the guy. He's going down a one-way street the wrong way. And the cop says, didn't you see the arrows? And he says, the arrows? I didn't even see the Indians. That was the joke. But I remember walking back and having him. Imagine being seven, being criticized.
Hilarious.
You know, I was just thinking.
What's that?
Don Rickles would drink the three vodkas.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing thing.
I have
thing.
It on good authority that that's what happened.
Like nowadays, they would drink like vegetable juice before they go on.
Right.
and they'll die at 20.
Right. Well, you said the other day that that was an era that Rickles represented the era when people were smoking and drinking.
Yeah.
It's an era of show business
like
gone.
Like Gleason on that show in Miami would have a drink in one hand, a cigarette in the other. And it was the coolest thing in the world to you watching it.
Yeah, that time it was normal. I mean, the commercial, Johnny Carson smoking cigarettes
behind
the desk.
Sure, sure. Tell us about meeting Carson, because I, in my research, I found a line that you used to describe it, which I loved. You said it was like getting in a cab by accident with Jesus.
I did?
Well,
that it was like that. It was, I mean, I just watching him from 16 and looking up. I mean, just had such an admiration for the whole thing, it was just amazing. So then when I met him, I was 26, and I remember I was in the makeup room. I never had makeup put on me in my life. That's a whole other thing I'll tell you soon. But he came in with the producer, and he was standing there, and he's talking to me, saying, yeah, okay, well, I'm glad you're here. I hope you go out there and have a good time. And I'm looking at him. He could have been saying to me, we're going to axe murder you after the show, and we're going to bury you in 5 different states. Is that all right with you? That's fine. That's very fine with me. He could have been saying, it was... Talk about surrealism. I mean, it was the closest.
The talking head on that lives in the person that lives in the television is now standing next to you talking.
It couldn't be any more powerful. It was incredible. It was very surreal. I got so nervous that I wasn't nervous anymore. I kind of got numb.
Because that was the largest crowd, too, when you got out there that you'd ever
performed. Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. You know that, too. The audience was 500 people. Even if it hadn't been televised, that was the biggest crowd I ever played.
Oh, yeah.
You know, 500 people. Incredible. Amazing. He changed my life twice because that's how I got it in my head that I wanted to be a stand-up from watching the show. So that was like my fantasy. I didn't think it would really happen, but it was like that was my dream, like a kid being a baseball player or an astronaut. So, it was embedded. That was my real thing. And then when I went on, then everything changed because I went on the show. So it was like twice. It's amazing how that can, a person can affect you that much that you don't even know the person really. But when you're that age, like 15, 16, 17, your mind is in a different level of imprinting. Like music can have an impact that won't later. You know, like for me, like the Beatles, Neil Young, Bob Dylan. You know, your mind is like receiving the world at a different level. It's taking more in and it's having more of an impact than any other time, I think, in your life, like 15 to like 28 or something, that your brain is at a different perspective.
Yeah, see, that's that thing. Well, like just, you don't understand being manipulated. You're more open to things. And all that changes when you get older. You become a lot more critical.
Yes. And self-conscious.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't come from famous people. You're from a pretty much a small town, and you're 26, and you're meeting Johnny Carson. So I think for anybody, that would have been intimidating.
It was still of all the things after that, that's still my favorite thing in my whole career is that first appearance and going on.
How soon did you get over to the couch?
That first time.
First appearance on national television, and I think you're going to find him a little different. Would you welcome Stephen Wright?
One time, right in the middle of a job interview, I took out a book and I started reading. The guy said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "Let me ask you one question. If you were in a vehicle and you were traveling at the speed of light, and then you turned your lights on, would they do anything?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Forget it then. I don't want to work for you." I've never seen electricity. That's why I don't pay for it. Right on the bill. Sorry, haven't seen it all month. A couple of nights ago, I came home very late, and I was having a little bit of trouble getting into my apartment, and I accidentally took out a car key, and I stuck it into the door and turned it, and the building started up. So I drove it around for a while. I went too fast, and the police pulled me over. They said, "Where do you live?" I said, "Right here."
Did you have more material prepared?
No, I wasn't even sure I was going to go there. They said, you know, they said they're going to wave you to leave. Look at Johnny and then look ahead and then leave. I looked at Johnny and looked ahead, and all the guys with the headphones were going like, you know, to go over. And if you see me, like, take a hesitant step, I couldn't even talk. He was, you should, if you ever watched it, he's asking me questions.
I've seen
and
it.
I'm like, he said, a lot of... so innocent. But it is good. You do things like years later. You know, when I was 28 or 30, I would think I would never try. If I hadn't done this, I would never try.
Oh my God.
It's insane.
Become rational.
that's what it is.
So you were 24. Gil, you were 15.
Yes.
Well, I was 23.
23. Actually. So if it had come to you both, the idea of being stand-ups just 5 years later.
Oh, my God.
Neither one of you would be sitting here.
It's just like I remember my parents would mention stuff like, you know, like air conditioner repair or TV repair.
Suggesting?
Something, yeah. You'd take lessons in it. You'd know how to do it. And it would be something, you know, an occupation, a skill. And nowadays it makes sense to me, even though no one gets anything repaired nowadays. Just toss
it. Well, I don't know about how you feel, but I feel very, very lucky, like, that to be doing this for a career. I mean, I for so many reasons, I'm lucky that the audience likes some people, like what I do, because if they didn't like this style, it's not like I had a plan B.
No.
Okay, I'll go do this type now. They don't like that one. I'll go to the third type. Right.
I'll do it with the French accent.
that's just luck that they like it. Not luck in the sense that wasn't, you know,
right.
Okay, they luck.
It's always serendipity involved.
And then to be able to do this, like, it's like we're in nursery, we're in a kindergarten, we're making stuff, we make things up, and that's our life. And do you feel fortunate to do that?
Well, it's so weird. I'm one of those people who never feels fortunate most of the time, and I hate when people say, oh, I've got no regrets in my life. I'm filled with regrets.
Oh, I have regrets, too.
But, when I think about it, like, I'm one of those people who's constantly going, oh, I have no career, I'm a failure, blah, blah, blah. But what snaps into my head is all of those years of struggling just to get on at a club for no money. And the trillions of other people over the years who would also come in every night. And you see them every night for God knows how long. And now I don't remember what they look like. I don't remember their names. They're all, I don't know if they're still alive. And I'm thinking of, I could have just as easily been one of those.
And then do you feel appreciative?
Yeah, yeah. I could have been one of those guys that you said, hey, remember that guy? Gary something, you know? Gilbert, I don't remember what he did. And, you know, and these people who just fall off the earth.
So you have some gratitude mixed in with the with the self-pity.
Well, yes.
That's nice.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good.
I the only thing now that I know I regret is my choice of co-host. That I don't have to think twice about.
That was beautiful, if I must say. Wow. That was nicely done. Steve, speaking of surrealism, I have to ask you about Appointments of Dennis Jennings and how it came together, which I watched again the other night.
Well,
and it's so good.
thank you. You know, I was doing a lot of appearances, and I did an HBO special, and then me and my friend Mike were talking, and he said, you should go to HBO and like, see if they want to do a short film with you. So I said, yeah, okay, yeah. So I went with my agent, and I said, you want a half an hour? Yeah, okay, yes, we should do that, okay. And then I came back, and I said, Mike, they want to do it now. I don't know what to do, though. I had no idea what to do. Mike, I knew from Emerson College.
Mike Armstrong?
Mike Armstrong, yes. And we would, he was head of the paint crew. I had a summer job painting the classes in the dorms during the summer of the school we went to. I had graduated, but now I'm painting this. And me and him would be in the same room painting. And painting is so boring. But all we would do was talk, and we would die laughing because Mike is a hilarious, just hilarious guy. And for some reason, we found psychiatry, a lot of comments about that. For, I don't know why, but that was one of our main things we would joke about. So then we said, because when I was going to write it with him, it was understood. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, well, what are we going to do? Well, how about psychiatrists? We made so many jokes. We didn't have any of those actual jokes in the thing, but we just found that profession hilarious. So that's how that happened.
And Atkinson's just great. You guys are just such a fun tandem. Oh. But, you know, I was watching it and looking, deconstructing some of those gags. I mean, and some of those gags are worthy of any great silent film. I mean, the waiter, when you're pouring the water.
Oh, yeah.
It's just real, really smart. Of course, I know Gilbert hasn't seen it.
Yeah, thanks. No. That's right. If it's something you're involved with, I usually avoid.
He just won an Oscar for it. No biggie.
Because you make me nervous, so I'd rather not have you know. Don't watch my stuff. Even if I'm not watching you, not watch it. It would make me nervous. We had a guy in one. There was in the background. A guy comes over. Oh, it was me. It was me. Mm-hmm. I come over and I give. There's a kid sitting at a table. Like Laurie Metcalf is talking, and I'm in the background. I put a thermometer in his mouth.
Fantastic.
And then I leave. Yeah. And a minute later, I come back and I look at the temperature like this, and then I just walk away. Like just.
There's
totally
so many great gags.
Surrealism.
Yeah. The tape, taking the tape out of the answering machine,
listening to the tape. Remember the big answering machine tapes?
Oh, yes.
So I put it in a Walkman, and I'm walking down the street listening to it, and I forget to, there's a lady on there saying you forgot to adopt, you adopted a child, and you never.
Then that's where you turn around and run.
Hi, Dennis, it's Emma. I'll be home later. Call me. Dennis. This is Linda Thompson calling from the adoption agency. When are you coming by to pick up that child you adopted?
This is Mrs. Wilson, your third grade history teacher. I suppose you think I'd forgotten about that book report on the Indians.
That just brings back something else. It's like that having nothing to do with showbiz even. I remember how like I was excited when I finally bought an answering machine. That was like such a miraculous thing. But now I think when people are watching a movie and they see an answering machine, they're going, what is that?
Hell is that? Yeah. Or you see the phones, like some guy will have a phone in his car, like the movie was made in 75. Like, and it's.
Oh, yeah. It's like Zach on Saved by the Bell and Jerry Seinfeld would have like a brick.
Oh, the big with phone with
yeah.
the antenna.
Yeah, the antenna.
Yeah.
Well.
And do you remember this?
Maybe we should be at the end, maybe.
We're wrapping it up. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, you want to get out?
No, I just have a gut feeling that I'm going to be killed at midnight. I'd like to get out.
I know what you're talking about.
I'd like to get one more evening in.
Anything you want to plug, you're working with Louie.
Oh, I was with Horace and Pete.
Yeah.
But that's over now. But what were you saying? You were saying something.
Were you going somewhere, Gil?
Oh.
No.
Oh, just one other thing. And that was, yes. I find, very weird. My outgoing message was always like, hi, leave a message and your name. Leave your name and message when you hear the beep. And that was it. And people would criticize me going, oh, that's funny. And these people used to try to be creative with their outgoing messages and try to be funny. And I hated.
Like it was a little show. Like.
Yeah, I hated funny outgoing messages.
Yeah, mine on my cell phone now is I mumbled on purpose. I seems like I'm talking, but I'm really, I'm like, there's like a couple words you can almost hear.
Yeah.
And I did it on purpose because, and the reaction is interesting. 80, 70% of the people don't even comment on it, which I found interesting. And the other people, what the hell are you talking about? What are you doing?
Well.
Okay.
We want to let this man out of the.
So we'll do it again for the next 5 days in a row?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Three.
We'll do it again in 15 minutes from now.
15 minutes.
You want to plug anything at all? You're in the Emoji movie? Nothing?
Oh, yeah. I'm in the Emoji doing a voice in that movie. Comes out in the end of July. And mainly I'm just performing live. That's it.
Are there any actresses you can imagine taking a shit that you'd like to talk about?
Actresses?
Yes.
You know, I have to get going. I'm double parked, even though I don't have a car.
We've done 180 of these, Stephen. This may be the strangest one we've ever done. I liked your other short, by the way, One Soldier, too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Reminded me of something called Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. You know?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
It's a dream.
It's the same. It's a little like that tonally.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, which is a compliment.
Tone. Thank you so much.
It's very good.
Thank you.
And I'm going to tell our listeners to please, if you have never seen The Appointments of Dennis Jennings, do so immediately. People listen to us. I don't know
why.
They actually take our recommendations.
This was a lot of fun, man.
I'm glad you
great.
Came.
I'm happy to do this.
And we never got to know what his favorite movie was.
Oh, before I go, one of those old business, new business.
Go quick, because we have another guest coming in.
Oh, okay. Some guy tweeted me. I think his name was like John Kenny.
Okay.
And he said that he thinks the serial killer who liked the song Seasons in the Sun was a serial killer named Joseph Callinger.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's from a previous show.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
Incredible.
Anyway.
Thank you. Because I was wondering.
Well, I saw.
Wonder no more.
You looked really bad when you came in. I mean, worse than usual.
You want to say anything about the Red Sox before you go?
No, I just hope they do good, and okay. I hope they keep playing in Fenway, because I'm used to it.
I used to write the Welcome Home Dinner.
You did?
Yeah, jokes for it. We'll talk about it later. Shall we let this man go get on with his life?
All right. Well, this is Gilbert Gottfried, and this has been Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal Podcast with my co-host, Frank Santopadre.
Your once one regret.
Again, we life. Asked my one regret. And once again, we've been recording at Nutmeg with our engineer, Frank Verderosa. And being a fucking killjoy has been Stephen Wright. Who doesn't realize if you're a guest on this show, you don't just fucking walk out. You don't just go, hey, you know, I'm tired of talking. You never turn to Jack Carter or Johnny Carson or Tom Snyder.
Ask me those questions about actors.
Yes. No, Jack Parr used to say, yeah, yes. He would say, can you imagine Jane Russell taking a shit?
Stephen, thanks for coming and taking a shit.
He would ask
abuse.
That of Adlai Stevenson when he'd be on the show.
Stephen is doubled over. He may be getting a nosebleed. Thanks for coming in, man.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, fun. Next time, write down the names of the actresses. So you can...
First guest that's ever made a getaway.
Get the closest, most comfortable shave you've ever experienced with Bull Goose Shaving Supplies. Whether you need a safety razor, shaving brush, shaving cream, or aftershave, Bull Goose has you covered. They've even designed their own line of stainless steel razors called Asylum Shave Works, which are machined to the tightest tolerances right here in the U.S. Just visit BullGooseShaving.com to change the way you shave today. And get 15% off all shaving soap, shaving creams, and aftershaves when you enter promo code Gilbert at checkout.